Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. I am having a really hard time talking. I'm not feeling good. I've been a bit under the weather this week, and I've been saying, you know, I'm not going to do an episode on Monday. We're just going to skip it. And here we are on Thursday, and we are going to do something. As soon as I start talking, just hear the raspiness in the voice, and it's going to be fun. I'm probably going to be hacking and whatever else is going on, but we will just cut those out, and it'll just seem like a raspy voice for the day, but we're going to push through. We're going to suck it up and drive on, because doggone it, stuff still has to get done. Today's warm-up song is Peace of My Heart by Janis Joplin, and no, I did not change the lyrics from man to woman throughout the song, because you are the only man for me. I'm going to jump right in here because I don't know how much I'm going to have between the vocal cords, the lungs, and whatever else I'm working with here. So we're going to try to hammer out a bee buzz. This should be episode 177 because in addition to me not feeling great, my brain is completely not working either. So I think it's episode 177. Just, you know, we'll figure it out. Okay, somebody had a message and said, hey, I got some drone comb in hopes of reducing my Varroa treatments. And number two, I've heard as part of that, I've heard that bees don't always work well with plastic foundation. Any tips? So it's a two-part thing here. This is a great tip that really has kind of gotten a lot of traction over the past, you know, I would say 4 or 5 years. A lot of people are really starting to do this. And what's going on is in the spring, wherever you are, take drone comb. And this is basically, if you've ever bought plastic foundation, the plastic foundation already has like an outline of where the comb should be. And the bees just use that as an outline and they make the hexagonal cells, you know, right where they're placed. If you buy this drone comb, it has larger cells. So they go ahead and draw out larger comb. And the queen says, oh, cool, larger comb. I'm going to lay a drone, you know, egg in here. It's just the same as the other eggs, just not fertilized. So people will take an entire, you know, frame of this drone comb, and the queen will lay it all up with drones, and the Varroa mites loves the drone brood because it's got a 3-day longer brood cycle, 24 days versus 21 days with a worker bee. So Varroa mites will tend to just go for the drone brood. And what you can do, there's a couple ways that you can kind of work with this. One popular thing is once all of the drone brood is at least laid up, it doesn't have to all be capped, but ideally if you can kind of let as much of it be capped as possible, you can take it out, put it in the freezer for a couple of days, and well, just overnight, whatever, just let it get frozen. And then you can go and the next day cut it open and use some tweezers and you can kind of extract them and you can see just how many mites that you have in there. Now, I mean, I guess you could theoretically, you know, pull 100 of them out or 300 of them out or whatever you wanted to do and kind of do a mite count like that. I haven't done it, but you could certainly do something like that if you wanted to. I think that drone brew is going to give you a pretty good representative, you know, count of what's going on in the colony, but it's going to be stacked a little bit heavier because of their preference towards drone brood. But either way, people will use these frames and do just, you know, what I described there. And then they'll take the frame and, you know, take it outside, scrape it off, leave it for the chickens or whatever. Chickens love drone brood. But it's just another tool you can use to kind of get an idea of what's in the colony. And then second to that is it's taking all these Varroa mites that would have been somewhere else in your colony reproducing, and they are out of the mix completely. So it's a really cool way to kind of do that. I know a lot of people now, they're dropping them in the spring, waiting for them to get filled, pulling them out, tossing it, throwing them in again. I mean, this is certainly not a all-inclusive Varroa strategy, but it is a cool, low-cost way to help manage and reduce Varroa without any chemicals, without, you know, it's really one of those things that fits in the category of treatment methods that don't require chemicals and other things. So it's a pretty cool way to go. Now, the second part two question of that is with bees not working well with plastic foundation, there are a few things you can do. When you first buy them, a lot of times when you get the frame, it'll be kind of, let's say, dipped in waxed or it'd be single dipped or whatever. If you take it from the package you get it in, you throw it into a colony, I've had pretty good results with that. If you put it in the garage or the shed or whatever and use it next season or even a couple of months later, whatever light film of wax was already on them diminishes. And they need to have something there to kind of let them know that this is where they should be drawing and how they should be doing it. So the couple things, the two or three things I've done is Some places will offer like double dipped, where I guess they dip the frame, it dries, they dip it again for a thicker coating of wax. That sounds like a pretty, you know, good step in the right direction. Another option that you could do is like I went and I bought a $3 pot from the thrift store, and I will save old comb that I scrape off of frames and, you know, off the hive and just scrap things that are anywhere. When you do, like if you do uncappings and you filtered out all your honey, you know, you can boil down some of the excess junk and just save the wax, and you can use that wax for this specific activity. But you'll just melt that down. I bought these little paint brushes at Harbor Freight. It was like, I don't know, 30 or 40 of them in a pack for $5. I use those for everything. I use them for this. The small little rollers work pretty well too, but you basically just melt the wax down and then just paint it onto, you know, the frames. I recommend at least one good thick coat. You could do a second coat if you wanted to, and experiment with it. You know, if you find that one, sorry, the voice is killing me. If you find that, you know, doing just one thick coat works and that's all you have to do, great. If you find that it takes two, maybe even three, just, you know, play around and see what works for you. But pre-coating them with something works really well. I have taken kind of like a ball of it, like just, you know, like a baseball size hunk of wax that I had, you know, sitting in a container, and just literally just kind of squished it down and just rubbed it on. If you've ever surfed before, you know, just kind of rubbed it across the whole thing, and then took a small little handheld propane torch and just went over it really lightly, really quickly to kind of melt it down. That was the super fast, quick way of doing it. It seems to work, but it's probably not the best thing to do, especially considering you're dealing with plastics and you really don't want to be heating plastics any more than you have to, but it does work in a pinch. Okay, the next one is, I live in the Virginia, North Carolina Tidewater area, which is my neck of the woods, and I'm getting a nuke in March, looking for guidance on getting the nuke installed and a little bit more about temperatures. So I think we actually covered this fairly well in our Discord room discussion the other day. But in this case, this was a overwintered nuke that I think somebody is getting like in the February timeframe, like late February, maybe early March. So this is a really vulnerable time for colonies. They're coming down to the end of the season. They're really low on resources typically. Now, it's interesting because in our area down here, we can get some really, really nice days in February. And, you know, they can start laying up a lot of brood. And then we have a couple of, we've had 2-3 weeks of really cold in March, which is pretty disruptive to that production of brood. And the last remaining bees of the cluster that are keeping things warm and trying to protect those developing brood. So it's a very vulnerable time. But if you are getting a nuke that is fully packed out, I think the real question was, do I put it into the box right away? Can I leave it overnight? What if I bring it in, you know, from where I get it and then it gets really cold? I would say that the smaller of the box or container you can keep them in and that they are comfortable with, you know, they're not overcrowded or anything, the smaller the better starting out. If you take them from a 5-frame nuke and throw them into a 10-frame deep, and then they've got all this extra space in there, and then we get some really cold nights, which I say really cold is also subjective. I'm saying like nights that are like around, you know, -5 to 0 Celsius, you know, 30, 35 Fahrenheit, somewhere in that area. Like it can be a little bit stressful. One night they can handle it usually pretty well, but a couple of nights in a row, it can be a little bit tricky. Not that a normal healthy colony couldn't do it. It's just, I don't know exactly what you're getting. Hopefully you're going to end up getting a nuke that's got pretty much like 3 to 4 frames of honey and maybe even a frame of some brood already, but the brood is even less important. I want a big cluster of bees. You're going to need a lot of bees in that nuke to make sure they can stay warm and have enough of them available to start foraging a little bit later in the spring as all the spring ramp up starts happening. Personally, I think that's a really early time to be getting a nuke in our area. So it's a little bit more high risk, but I would almost say to keep them in the nuke box as long as you can, just because it's a smaller space to heat. And maybe even consider some outside and top insulation on that as well, just to give them maximum, you know, heat retention. All right, so let's go on to the next one here. We have, is it better to combine 2 weak colonies before winter or try to overwinter them separately? This is a very, very common question that we get. And I've had a lot of, in fact, somebody just reached out the other day and they said, hey, I kind of took the advice that you mentioned about, you know, not trying to rob from healthy colonies and give to bad colonies. And they kind of explained the whole situation they were in. And they felt that they made the right call by not trying to continue on with the weaker colony. I always recommend, you know, it's easy, like super easy to split in the spring. There's so much positive activity with the bees in the spring with the, you know, with the nice flow and everything's in bloom and the bees are happy. It's really hard to do things wrong in the spring. So if you had, let's say, five colonies and maybe two of them just were not looking great, it's going to be really easy for you to combine two of them into the other three, go into the winter with three, maybe you lose one, and then that following spring, you're going to go from two to at least four, maybe five or six if you wanted to. So you'll be right back where you were. The only difference is this time you're taking the overwintered genetics with you. So to me, it's almost a good thing to phase out the genetics that aren't going to be good for your area. Take the ones that have overwintered and use that overwintering genetics for breeding your queens and for making new queen cells and making new colonies. Okay, next, what happens if my colony goes queenless late in the season? So this kind of can happen for a variety of reasons. There are certainly late season swarms happen, and you'll have a swarm. They left queen cells behind. Hooray, that's great. And then these queens emerge, these virgin queens emerge, they go out and try to get mated, and you just never see them again. You know, that's a real challenge. Getting queens mated late in the season can be challenging. They face all the regular challenges still with predation and with just anything else that could go wrong. But in addition to that, they're going to be looking at probably 10 to 15% maybe of the actual available drone population that they would see in the spring. So open mating of virgin queens is very challenging late in the season. Of course, there's always the scenario where, you know, you could accidentally manipulate a frame in the wrong way that results in her death. There could be, you know, you could be in a situation where you've determined that you don't like the temperament, the hygiene, some other thing going on within the colony, and you've decided, hey, look, it's time to remove this queen and do something. So the answer, what happens? Anytime you have a queenless colony, you have a problem. Nothing else can go right within the colony because the queen pheromone drives activity, right? The queen pheromone is present and thereby does lots of other things. So one of them, as an example, just real quick here, queen pheromone suppresses ovary development in worker honeybees. If worker honeybees have no queen, their ovaries can begin to develop, and then you start getting what they call a laying worker. And this is where you'll see all kinds of random eggs. You'll see eggs inside of cells where there's two or three eggs in one cell. They're quite often hanging from the side walls of the cell because the abdomen of the queen is much longer. She's able to deposit the egg all the way down to the bottom of the cell, where the worker, of course, is much shorter. So she just goes as far as she can and, you know, drops it on the side. Lots of signs and things you can observe to determine that you have a laying worker. But that's just one of the many examples of how the pheromone is critically important within the hive. And when that queen is gone, lots of things are going to be disrupted with that. So you have a problem. The best course of action from here, I think, would be if the colony is doing well, like it's a very strong colony, things have been going well for them, they've got plenty of honey stores. I mean, everything is ready for them to go into the winter. They just don't have a queen. That's where I would be looking, like, okay, can I find a mated queen somewhere locally? Is there somebody who might be able to ship one in? You know, we're into the end of October. Lots of places in the U.S. right now, you know, you can't do that. Not a lot of places are breeding queens, and shipping them is really risky just with the temperature, you know, where they may have you may have 70 during the day Fahrenheit and end up at like 45 at night or something like that. It's just not going to do well to ship them. So you're in a bind. So that kind of almost goes back to the previous question, right? What do I do with a weak colony? Well, if it doesn't have a queen, it's going to introduce a lot of weakness. And I would take probably the same course of action. If there's no way for you to replace that queen, that might be a good opportunity to go ahead and, you know, combine that colony with another one or distribute the resources of that colony to your other colonies and hopefully boost them up and increase their likelihood of survival. And then again, you can always split in the spring. Should I leave brood frames in the hive if they're mostly empty? So this is kind of a tough bit of a juggling act. You know, it's kind of like, what do you do? What do you not do? in the spring when things kick off. I'll tell you what, before we go to the spring, let's just talk about what's going on in the tree. So you have your tree cavity and the bees go to the very top of the tree and they start drawing some comb downward. And whatever comes in, it's going in that comb. Whatever they have available, they're just going to put it, you know, wherever they can put it just to get things established. But once everything is completely drawn out, what you end up with inside the cavity are just long sheets of comb. And they will always put, you know, just assuming this late in the season, like it would be right now, and you envision a tree, just envision like a regular tree in your yard. Go right to the middle of that and just pick a section that's, say, about 2 feet high or one meter, 3/4 of a meter high. Okay, that's where my bees are. And inside of that, you're going to have these big sheets of comb. The outside and the top is going to be completely wrapped basically in honey. All of the comb that's on those areas is going to be all honey. And then from the top, you know, even the top third to top half or so is still going to be honey as well. And then they'll have brood down towards the bottom. So as they start to move that cluster and they're consuming resources and they work their way back up to the top, they are then going to just repeat the process in the spring. So they don't say, okay, spring is here. Let's all go back to the bottom and start working our way back up. They will start, you know, as nectar and resources come in, they start bringing things in, they'll lay things up in the top and they just repeat and just kind of fill to the bottom. And then they go, you know, back and forth, up and down, moving about to, you know, make use of all of the space within the cavity. So they never remove space. They are never, you know, taking, because obviously they can't do that. Now you as the beekeeper, let's say you put your deep down and you've got everything drawn out. Maybe you have like seven or eight frames are drawn out. You go ahead and add another deep on top of that. They start working that up. I mean, it's springtime. Things are cranking. Things are going great. You get a honey super on there. And what I see happen quite a bit is as I keep building up, they keep moving up and building up. And then you'll end up with a scenario where you have, as an example, maybe from the top down, you'll have, say, two honey supers, maybe even three that are just completely full of honey. Then you'll have your deep up there that's got a bunch of brood in the middle and some honey on the sides. And then you'll have a full deep on the bottom loaded with comb and there's nothing in it. I've had this happen numerous times. It's kind of par for the course. And I've done two different things with this. In my earlier years, I would say, oh, wow, we need to move all of this around and make sure that they have more space. And I would take all of these pieces of comb and I would just like move everything down to the bottom and give them more space up top. I'm like, well, they're running out of space up top. They need more space. I think this is the bad approach. I think this is not the right way to go. Now what I would do, exact same scenario, and I'll just review it again just to make sure we're on the same page. We have two or three honey supers, a deep that's full of brood in the middle and some honey and, you know, other capped resources on the sides, capped honey on the side, resources within the hive, and the bottom deep has nothing in it. I just take it out. If it has nothing in it, then it brings no value to the colony. Now, the little asterisk with this is you're going to need and want to add this space in the spring. So I can't really tell you what it's going to look like for your area, but I would say for me, we start that ramp up late February, early March. The activity really kicks in typically like mid to late March, but I mean, I'm getting swarms. We get swarms as early as mid-March, but typically like March 15, 18, 20, all the way through mid-April. That's that whole swarming range in my area, depending on whether I'm talking about like my house or I'm talking about like the rural property, either one, they'll swarm a little bit earlier out there. In fact, typically because the resources tend to be a little bit more abundant there, but anything in that time frame, they will build out really, really quickly and they will want to swarm. So my recommendation is if you pull that box out, which is, I think, a great idea, right? It gives them less space to heat and maintain. They've got plenty of resources in the hive still, plenty of space to move up and consume and do what they want to do. And I think that's a great strategy. Do you have to do it? No. Like I said, for many years, I tried the two things I did was completely leaving it alone. And then what I would do is in the spring, whenever there were resources still left in that upper deep, I would just reverse them. I would switch them around so that we had resources at the bottom, empty space in the top deep. And then I would remove excess honey supers. I don't overwinter with like two or three honey supers. I was just kind of trying to make an example that using, if you have the two deeps kind of configuration with anything above it, It's that lower one that is less important. But what I've done in my configurations has, or what I've done in my overwintering kind of setup has either been nothing at all. So I have double deep, single honey super. They work their way up. When they backfill in the fall, they don't even touch the bottom. Everything is in the top deep and the super. And in the spring, they just start all over again and they're fine. I've done that where I flipped them in the spring, where I left that honey super up top, moved the middle, you know, the middle box, the upper deep, moved that to the bottom and reversed them. I thought that that would help in some way. I don't think it does. I don't think it makes a big difference because they will still continue to work down and work throughout the available space. And I can feel my semi-sick brain going into tangent mode, and I'm getting out of control here. So to just generically answer this, if you have space that is not being used by the bees, let's go ahead and get that out. I don't mean individual frames. Like if you have an entire box of drawn comb that was honey, nectar, pollen, capped, uncapped, whatever it was, if it's empty, just go ahead and take it out.
The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful, with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. When I was scrolling through their site yesterday, I actually ordered a retro 70s Give a Hoot, Don't Pollute t-shirt with Woodsy the Owl on it. It instantly took me back to my childhood. That's exactly the kind of things you'll find at Uncommon Goods. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. They have something for everyone. Plus, every time you shop, Uncommon Goods gives back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice with each purchase. They've already donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next order, go to uncommongoods.com/honey. That's uncommongoods.com/honey for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary. That first cup of coffee really sets the tone for the whole day. If you haven't tried an AeroPress yet, you're in for something special. AeroPress uses a unique brewing method that delivers a smooth, rich, and balanced cup of coffee with less bitterness. So you actually taste the roast, the origin, and the full character of the beans. Smooth, balanced, and full-bodied. It's like the best part of a French press, a pour-over, and even espresso combined into one compact brewer. And it's built for real life. Durable, portable, and consistently great whether you're at home, at work, on the road, camping, or traveling anywhere life takes you. Plus, it's the fastest single cup maker out there. About 2 minutes start to finish, including cleanup, so you're never waiting long for great coffee. AeroPress is shockingly affordable, less than $50, and we've got an incredible offer. Visit AeroPress.com/honey. That's AeroPress.com/honey, and use promo code honey to save 20% off your order. That's AeroPress.com/honey, promo code honey at checkout. So ditch the drive-through, skip the bulky gear, and start your mornings with a better cup of coffee wherever you are. Big thanks to AeroPress for sponsoring this show.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Okay, what role does pollen or pollen substitute play in late fall prep? So I'm going to key in on the word or the words late fall. The late fall prep, it's basically non-existent. Early fall, like late summer, early fall, you do still need pollen because pollen and the nectar combined together are critical components of making royal jelly, which is what all workers are going to receive for the first few days of their life. Once they're out of the egg and into the larval phase. So you have to have pollen for that. Outside of rearing that late brood, which would be your winter, you know, your winter bees, you don't need pollen. Whatever little bits of pollen or bee bread that they may have stored within the hive, that should be enough for them to have resources available for them to start rearing new brood at the end of the winter, at the beginning of the spring. So if you are getting pollen patties, generically saying pollen patty, if you're getting a patty of any sort or a supplement of any sort, focus on the carbs and the sugars. They're trying to pack on as much fat as they can to allow them to overwinter. And having excess pollen really can just disrupt their gastrointestinal tracts. It can cause them to need to, you know, they only get cleansing flights. Again, it depends on where you live, but they may not get cleansing flights for months at a time. And you can have, if you have excess pollen, there still is going to be pollen in the gut of the bee, which is a pretty fascinating thing to do research on. I was reading some things that Randy Oliver had done and in this space where he expected there to be no pollen in the gut of the bees over the winter. And he did a dissection and determined that there was actually quite a bit that was still in the gut. But having too much can lead for them to have a need to evacuate. And they may do that in the hive. Now you're potentially spreading disease. You know, Nosema might be present in the bees, but in control. Now they're defecating maybe where they shouldn't be because they have this urgency because of the excess pollen. And so stay away from the pollens. Just strictly focus on, sugars, carbs. Okay, let's see. Next we have, should I feed protein patties in winter or will that cause problems? Actually, I don't know why I didn't combine those before. Cause that's kind of the same thing, right? Now, what you can do and what I have done is I've put a patty at the top that is a more protein heavy patty, but I don't put that on in the fall. Like I would put that on in February, maybe like mid to late February, wherever I catch that nice warm day in February, I might add a protein heavy patty at the top of the hive at that time, but no time prior to that. Is it safe to leave frames of uncapped nectar in the hive going into cold weather? I actually had an email about this the other day. It was on, and somebody else had asked about it previously. So I was just talking about this. And I guess somebody had advised the person who emailed that this can adversely affect the moisture balance in the hive, having uncapped nectar. So I'm not aware of any of this being a problem. Bees are going to gather resources whenever they can. If there is something in the environment that happens to come into bloom, they're going to bring it in. Now, the temperature inside the hive is going to be somewhere, on the lower end, but somewhere probably between like 50 and 90 degrees, something like that. They're going to be generating heat, and anything that may be uncapped can still evaporate. There's a lot of moisture that's being generated in the hive because of the respiration and the, a little bit of condensation and things like that. But you shouldn't have, let's say, for example, you have 20 frames in your hive. You shouldn't have 20 frames of open nectar. You might have one or a piece of one or a piece of four or five, like sections of a few of them. They're probably just going to go ahead and consume whatever is open first because they know, cool, it's open. If we just eat this when we're hungry, we don't have to worry about capping it. We don't have to worry about uncapping it. So for them, it's fine. They're just going to consume that a little bit earlier. And if it needs to be capped, they can always cap it as they go while they're in the hive. But the only time where I see it being an issue is when there would be so much of it present in a already very humid and wet environment. And then you run, some risk of some fermentation, possibly. I think that could certainly happen. But I'm racking my brain here to think of when, I've definitely had colonies go into winter with four or five frames of open nectar. It happens all the time because I'm feeding them at the end of the year. But once it gets too cold, there's that window, but between when it gets too cold to feed them and when it's too cold for them to do anything. And usually during that window, they're able to get things capped. And if it doesn't get capped, it gets consumed. So I have not scientifically analyzed this. I haven't put cameras in the hive and, taken samples of the open nectar at 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks or whatever to see if there's an increased level of fermentation or any kind of degradation I haven't seen it. I haven't done it. So I can't speak to it from a scientific standpoint. My observation is that it's never been an issue and I have never been concerned about it. Can I move frames of honey from a strong colony to help a weaker one? I've said it many times before. I'm not a huge fan of this. Now the kind of asterisk to this is what is the reason that the colony is a weaker colony? You can have amazing genetics, and for whatever reason you wanted to voluntarily, or you were forced to do some kind of a later season split, or maybe you had a different plan and your plan didn't exactly work the way you wanted, so you had to make a change, and you have this colony that has good genetics, they're just behind the curve. That's not a situation where you're feeding, you're taking from healthy, good stock to give to bad stock. That's just a circumstantial kind of situation. Broadly speaking, I don't want to take from the strong and give to the weak. That is not an effective strategy for honeybee management. But let's say that you know in your area you need about 70 or 80 pounds of honey for a colony to overwinter under a given set of circumstances, normal, average year, whatever it might be. And you're sitting on 90, 100, 120 pounds of honey. And you got a colony over there with 50. Maybe it was a nuke that you made in July. They've got 50 pounds, and man, it sure would be nice to give them, you know, another 7 or 8 frames and, you know, give them a little bit of a buffer to help for the winter. I have no problem with that. The good news is they're your bees, right? You do whatever you want to do. So if you want to give to the, you know, steal from the rich to give to the poor kind of thing, by all means, give it a shot. I wouldn't do it for bad genetics, but for good genetics, when there is surplus, by all means, absolutely. And also, please remember to keep documentation. I know I kind of harp on this a lot, but documenting everything to say, hey, colony number one had about 100 pounds of honey. I took 20 pounds, gave it to colony number two. Colony number two was my late season split. Whatever you have to do to track and keep notes and leverage technology, right? Even if you're not a big techno geek kind of person, I've found that using ChatGPT for this specific purpose is amazing. I take my, you know, that cheap mic. I did the video on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, I think the title of it is like $17 mic and ChatGPT, never take written notes again, something like that. But what I did was I took a cheap mic that I bought on Amazon. The audio quality is not great, but it's definitely good enough for this project. I hooked the mic up. I just talk while I'm doing the inspection. I'm like, okay, I'm in hive number 5 right now. Okay. And I literally will spend 2, 3, 10, however many minutes it is, talking about that hive. And then I go on to the next one. And when I'm done, I take the audio file. I go to Riverside, just do a search for Riverside. They do free transcripts. So I do use Riverside. I think it's riverside.com, riverside.fm, something like that. I do a free transcript of the audio. It puts in a text file. I go to ChatGPT and I say, hey, ChatGPT, can you take this text file that I have here? It is a transcript from my bee inspection. Can you make it into a table? Rows and columns. I need the rows to be identified by hive number, and the columns, I want you to capture everything that is important. The things that I think are important are the following, you know, and you might say whatever's important to you, right? And have it put those things, or ask it, say, hey, can you put everything that's important into this spreadsheet and put it into a CSV format so I can export it? And then it'll export all the data into the spreadsheet. Now you have all your information. And there's lots of more advanced things you can do over time, and you can migrate that data into different lightweight home databases, which that's where it starts to get a little bit more, you know, you got to get a little more technical. But you can now have a text document and a CSV or a .xls kind of spreadsheet that you can use to look at data from your hives and aggregate that data. Like, you could then take all of those notes. Let's say, for example, you just did a single audio file for every colony. You have 4 or 5 colonies, so it's really easy to do. Now you've got 20 audio files that are in text. You've got your transcriptions. You have text of these 20 audio files. You hand it to ChatGPT and you say, hey, listen, ChatGPT, these are the 20 inspections I did on this colony this year. Can you aggregate all the data and put this into a table and have a slight narrative or a small narrative at the end that describes the overall health of this colony? And it can extract all the data, put it into the table, track all your metrics, you know, figure out going into it what's important to you, what things do you want to track, and then just make sure, maybe you have a 3x5 card while you're doing your inspection that you can look at to make sure you're saying, how many brood frames? Okay, I see there are 3 frames of brood. Did I see the queen? Yeah, I had eyes on the queen today. You know, you can go through, and once you get your system down, it'll automatically start populating all these things, and it'll really helpful for reporting. So again, if you don't like the technology for whatever reason, you don't want it to, you know, to hack your life and, you know, steal your wife and kids or whatever, I get it, but it definitely makes life easier. But keep track, keep notes of everything so that you can go back and track the things that you're doing, the things that are working, the things that aren't working, especially as it relates to some genetic things like this. When you have colonies that are weaker for whatever reason, and you say, hey, you know, I boosted them up, and in the spring, it was like a whole new colony. They just came around and they really, really thrived. So I'm going to lean towards helping any colony I can if I have surplus. cool. Your apiary, do it how you want to do it, right? Do it your way and don't worry about what anybody else has to say. Okay, let's see here. I've got so many more questions, but like my chest is on fire and I don't think I can go much more. So let's see. I'm going to do one more. Okay, how often should I check emergency feed like sugar bricks or candy boards? So this is it's a little bit of a religious kind of thing. I don't use the sugar bricks, the fondants, the candy boards. I don't use any of that. Decision that I made years ago from number one, using it and them not. Like I would spend money to put these things in the hive. They didn't care about it. And then I found that if I just focused on genetics and had the right genetics in my apiary, that they would just automatically store the stuff that they need. They would store the honey that they need to survive. I don't have to give them inferior things that they don't want. So, you know, if you've been listening for like more than a year, you know what a weirdo I am about sugar, but like you just don't put granulated sugar in a beehive. I'm never coming off of that one. But if you want to use these things and you want your bees to, you know, break the cluster and go up into the top and, you know, salivate on a block of sugar and, you know, lick that up and that's going to save the colony, then you'll have to ask people who do that kind of stuff. I'm not going to really advocate for it. I know there are people who every day it's above 50 degrees, they're getting into their hives in the wintertime. I do not do that ever. Unless the hive is on fire or something is attacking the hive or there's something weird going on, I close up shop usually by like now. Like by this time of year, I'm pretty much not going into my hives, maybe as late as the first week of November under certain conditions or whatever. But November, December, January is a no-touch zone for me. I don't do anything until the first warm day in February. If I were further north and west of where I am, I might push that out to the first week of March, you know, before I get in. But again, that's what works for me. You're going to have people, I guarantee you, you're going to have people saying, well, Jeff, if you don't get in the hive and you're not looking at them, you're a bad beekeeper. No, I am a beekeeper who likes to have the right genetics in my hive. And I can't afford to spend thousands of dollars in feed. And if I could, I wouldn't want to spend thousands of dollars in feed when I can just take the really super simple process of breeding the right genetics in my apiary. Like when you breed the genetics that are good for your area, you don't have to feed. Guys, you don't have to do this. I put fondant in the hive for the last time about 12 years ago, 11 years ago. Like, yes, I have no bees in my yard right now. There are no bees at my house in my yard right now. If I had bees here, none of them would have anything in the hive that the bees did not gather themselves. Whether they may have been from a feeder. They may have gathered sugar syrup because if they're light, I am going to feed them going into the winter. If they cannot figure it out by this time of year, then those genetics are probably not right for me. And you might say, well, Jeff, how do you know? Well, you know, because they die. And if those die, then I will take one. Let's say I had 20 hives here at my house. If 15 of them made it and 5 of them didn't, then the 15 that are remaining, those are the ones I'm going to start looking at for, okay, these are all overwintered colonies, overwintered queens. I'm now marking and labeling, right? Because I'm keeping track not only by colony, but more importantly by queen. Because I can take a colony that's not doing well, a colony that's doing great, reverse the queens, and magically the other colony starts doing better and the other one starts doing worse, right? We know it's tied to the genetics of the queen for like 90%+ of all things going on. Randomly made up statistic, by the way. Yeah, maybe it's harsh, maybe it's cruel, maybe it's bad husbandry on my part. I don't think so. I think there are times when it makes sense and there are times when it doesn't. If I were a cattle farmer and I'm feeding my cattle, and I have 5% of them that keep getting sick and they don't eat enough food and they're not healthy, I'm not going to spend thousands of dollars to get them supplements and organic this and all these other things. I'm going to send them to market or whatever. I'm assuming I'm not a cattle farmer, but I mean, you know, you're going to get rid of that stock for whatever reason. They're going to become hamburgers or whatever else you got to do because you can't throw good money after bad. And anybody who's been beekeeping for more than about 6 months can tell you like how expensive it gets. If you haven't done, you know, if you don't know, go check out the YouTube video, youtube.com/@beekeepingfornewbies, N-E-W-B-E-E-S. There's a video in there, how expensive is beekeeping? And I go through the whole thing talking about buying the hardware, the bees themselves, the Varroa treatments. You know, hey, you probably want to have at least 2 colonies versus 3 or versus 1. And it's expensive. And if you want to keep propping up bad genetics and you can afford to do so, then do it. Have fun, right? Why not? That's just not my strategy. It's not scalable, and I don't want to waste money that way. So that's enough of my rant. Okay, everybody, like I can feel like the sweat coming down my head and my lungs are on fire, and I'm having to break a lot here to just keep something, you know, keep drinking some coffee and some, which, you know, I'm sure somebody's going to beat me up about drinking like a diuretic when I'm sick, but I gotta get the life juice. Otherwise I'm going to be curled up in a ball somewhere crying. So this is a B buzz that once again, like I think I made it to question 8 or, well, there were 2 of them at the beginning. So we did 10 and I've still got like 15 or so more. I don't know why I can never seem to get through all of these, but maybe I just ramble too much. Anyway, folks, I'm going to go take some vitamin C and some vitamin D and whatever else I can find laying around the house. We'll try to catch up with you next week. Maybe I'll finish up this bee buzz, and I think we'll try and do a bees in the news. I got to figure out what everybody's asking about, whatever the most, you know, the biggest questions are that are coming in. We'll try to tackle that. We'll see what's going on. I'm just going to try to go drink some water and some Gatorade or whatever. So take care. Be kind to one another. Remember that I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.